This is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon. I'm Vilma Santiago Irizarry. I'm director of the Latino Studies Program. And it is my privilege and my pleasure to welcome you to a panel on arts and immigration sponsored by the Latino Studies Program as our contribution to this series of events celebrating Junot Diaz's work and the recognition that the Cornell Council of the Arts has bestowed upon him as last year's Pulitzer Prize winner in fiction writing by choosing him as Eisner Artist of the Year. This is a significant benchmark for our Latino community here at Cornell. This panel, formerly entitled Arts and the Impact on Immigration, is largely composed of colleagues who are teaching an affiliated faculty in the Latino Studies programs. And thinking about what I would do to welcome you or set the tone or bracket or contextualize the panel, I remember some 20 years ago when I was a graduate student in Anthropology of Dance and Human Movement at NYU and a research assistant at the National Arts Education Research Center, a research center on arts education that was supported by the National Endowment for the Arts. I encountered their report, an NEA published report, called Toward Civilization, which purported to be a report on the state of arts education in the United States. And I found that report quite problematic. Leaving aside the evolutionistic tone of the report's title itself, it had certain depictions about something that it called, quote, American civilization, which I found somewhat debatable. For example, it defined American civilization as having, quote, a central core, unquote, which included such artists as Cervantes, Praxiteles, Michelangelo, Velázquez, Bach, Mozart, and so on. This core was further characterized as being European, with some strains of Africa, Asia, and the rest of the Americas. The report was illustrated with images that included Picasso's Guernica, a photograph of Fred Astaire, French cathedrals, the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, and so on. What problems did I have with that, and why do I remember that when I think of this panel? As I see it, the so-called core of U.S. society, and particularly as far as the arts, artworks, artists, and artistic production are concerned, for me lies in the nation's intrinsic diversity and the incorporation of much more complex representational and expressive strands largely emanating among its immigrant and minoritized individuals and communities. And this is something that I would invite the panelists to talk about in the dialogue that I hope we can open up among ourselves this afternoon. But now, because this isn't about me, this is about my colleagues, arts, immigration, Junot's work, and so on and so forth, I would like to introduce one of our most highly regarded colleagues, an inspired artist, an award-winning writer in her own right, Professor Elena Viramontes, who will be introducing the panel. I feel I have a debt with Elena because it was Elena who recruited us to sponsor this program, this panel. And I know that she has been an ongoing collaborator with the Latino Studies Program, and I know that we are very close to her heart. So I would like to invite you to welcome Elena.
I would like to welcome all of you. I think that whenever I think about art, I always think about politics. And it's funny because people don't seem to reconcile that. And that's all that we're all about sometimes, especially in the Latino and the Latina community. In any event, what I would like to do is introduce the moderator, my colleague and good friend, fiction writer, Ernesto Quiñones, who is a novelist, journalist, a screenwriter, and who has, in fact, adapted his most famous novel, Bodega Dreams, to film, and it has been optioned by Freddy Rodriguez of 6 Feet Under fame. And I know I'm embarrassing him, but it would be Ernesto who will introduce the panel. And I want to thank Juno for his very, very busy schedule and giving us the time, and Sophia and Amy and Roberto. This is a powerhouse, powerhouse panel. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all for coming, and thanks, Elena, and thanks, Dilma. Let me introduce Roberto on this side, Roberto Sierra. He's chair of music. Aquí está Amy, and she's a chair of theater, film, and dance. I'm surrounded by chairs. And this is Sophia. She's not a chair, but that is okay. And once again, Juno Diaz, who, when you win such an award as a Pulitzer Prize, your life becomes a circus. It really does, up and down. And everybody wants something from you, a pound of you, and that includes Cornell. And we are so happy he is here. We're so happy that he is here. Okay, let me just begin. Let me just throw out this question about immigration. And because this is Latino studies, we're going to deal mostly with the ethnicity of Latino, with the Latino peoples, not exactly other immigration. The other Ethiopians, the Arabs are also coming to the United States. But let's deal with just Latinos for the sake of Latino studies. Let me ask the question to anyone who wants to take it about what the super Latino constituency, supposedly the sleeping giant, when all Latinos, Chicanos, Puerto Ricanos, Dominicans, Ecuadorians, Colombianos, supposedly will get together and form the big super Latino group that's going to have so much political pull and economic pull and social pull. Is that a possibility or is that a myth?
I'm going to go for it. And I think I'll go for it by saying that I'm not a Latina. And I want that to have political resonance or something. Brief biographical, autobiographical tidbit, and then to the super Latino possibility. So my grandfather was Cuban and came to the United States in the 30s, was a cigar maker, married my grandmother, they had my father. He abandoned my grandmother when my father was 2. And when he died, we discovered that he was a CIA operative and had married my grandmother, who's a member of the Communist Party, in order to spy on her. And so my relationship to Latino identity is complicated, right? My father learned Spanish when he was 50. He spent his life working with farm workers in California. So I am Latino politically, and I believe that there are possibilities for affiliation that aren't based on origin or identity, but on political affiliation, solidarity. I still believe in those things. So that's my take on the super Latino. Maybe I'm part of it.
Juno, what do you think? If you want to take this question, is it possible?
I mean, certainly, you know, it's certainly possible. But I think that the larger conditions of I think as the current narrative of the way identities are constructed in the Americas, that's my limited knowledge, and I have an incredibly limited knowledge even of that. Given the fact that communities are being fragmented at the speed of light, they're being atomized in ways that I think are hard for us to understand. The level kind of the way that folks are being parsed. And a lot of this, of course, is happening not only at the level of capital, the level of consumer, but just the way that, collectives are being sort of turned into anathemas. I think that anything that's going to sort of create a super Latino or anything that's going to create a new possibility for larger and more powerful, by me by powerful, more productive and more humane collectives is going to require a narrative that currently doesn't exist. I don't think there's any way that we can construct a narrative that will make us a more powerful collective out of what we have right now. I mean, perhaps that's a possibility. We've always been good at salvaging what we think crap and making it into gold. But my sense of it is that that right now the forces that are fragmenting people have at their disposal narratives of astonishing power and reach. Narratives of enormous, we could say, stickiness. And one of the things I think that's the challenge for any of us, whether we're artists, whether we're community workers, whether we're people who don't want to live in these sort of isolated little capsules separated by other people because of what we watch and what we listen to and what we buy and what we fear, I think that the real challenge will be that to curb the creation, or at least sort of the restructuring of the kind of narrative that's going to make this possible. But I think what I think is happening is that most of the folks who are being, you know, broken apart into 25 million pieces are not the ones who are being asked to take part in the creation of the narratives that might help us come back together. Usually the people who meet the hammer are never the ones who are asked to help engineer the solution. And I think that that's part of what's going on, is that, the folks, and by folks I mean the forces and the sort of orders that want to keep people kind of splintered up, they've got trillions of dollars and they've got incredible amounts of experts. But the only experts we have, we sort of make sure they're downstairs, like, washing the floors and, like, cooking, you know. And, I mean, I love our panel. It's really great and stuff. But the truth of it is that our brains haven't sufficed to now. You know, that we haven't been able to create the narratives that we need. And part of that comes from not being able to organize correctly a new, we could say economy, but I would prefer to say ecology, a new ecology of narrative creation, because it's going to be a story. It's not going to be anything else. You know, it's got to be a narrative that makes this happen. You know, and what that might be, who knows? And whether we're capable of creating it, I think, is always a possibility. But I think the first step to creating anything new is to sort of admitting how poorly a job we're doing, you know, and it's not our fault we're doing a poor job. I mean, you know, blame is an easy thing to ship around, but just to sort of get a sense of that these guys are kicking our ass. I mean, if it was baseball, it would be 4,011-0, you know, and the fact that we've done such a good job, I mean, all these communities have done such a good job of surviving and of maintaining creativity and of maintaining force and of being active and of resistance, I think speaks really well to the nature of what it is to be human. You know, I mean, Jesus, given the forces stacked against humanity, we're doing a pretty damn good job, you know, of just creating art and being alive and really keeping community. But I think that for a super Latino identity, we're going to need a super story. And, you know, and I think that the first thing we need more than we need hope. You know,
using that as a springboard, the new narrative, the super story. I would argue that the super story was actually introduced by Simón Bolívar way back in when he tried to form Gran Colombia and try to get Colombia, what's now Colombia, Ecuador, Venezuela, all together. As he said, "Si no se nos tira la águila se nos tira encima," which is exactly what happened. The eagle jumped us, which was the United States. With that, I'd like to ask Sophia, what do you see in education about this big, supposedly, possibility of the super Latino? Mm-hmm. Which is an old story, really.
Yeah. Wow, so I'm an educational ethnographer, and I'm studying new Latino destinations and working with parents and families. And so in our field of Latino immigrant education, I think all of our energies have been about challenging the deficit perspective of families, right? And blaming families for the educational crisis, right? You know, 50% dropout, you know, in some states, across the country in some school districts, 50% dropout of Latinos. I guess 35% dropouts, you know, nationwide, or pushouts, right? Latinos being pushed out nationwide. And so we're trying to, we've been consumed, you know, with challenging the deficit perspective that blames the families, the parents don't care, parents are backward, parents don't know how to educate their children. When I was in North Carolina, immediately they started classes on, and they announced in the newspapers, classes to help Hispanics become better mothers, right? This kind of assumption that Latinas are not good mothers. And so all our research has been about challenging this deficit perspective. All our energies has gone to that. And so we've done a great job in excavating, what are our strengths and our cultural resources from the home space. In the late 80s, mid to late 80s, Concha Delgado Gaitan, an educational anthropologist, was one of the first ones to talk about the cuentos, the canciones, right, the stories, the songs, the consejos, the narrative advice, right, the ways that parents teach their children through consejos, the games, and to look at these as strengths in the family. And also, we've also come a long way in just reconceptualizing culture and looking at all the different, hybrid cultural practices that families and parents and youth participate in, to not see culture as traits, but as historical, linguistic, cultural communities of practice. And so we've done all that, but I think we're still caught in always responding to that deficit perspective, and also to responding to the real, like, when I'm in the classroom and my students who are prospective teachers, they want to know, like, who are real Latinos? Like, who are Latino immigrant families? What are they like? And that's always very dangerous. When I engage in that conversation, well, when we look at, through educational anthropology and through our scholarship and research, we're always saying Latinos are not like that. They're not, lazy, all of these stereotypes. They're like this, right? Or they do this. And so we're kind of always falling into the trap of the real, who are the real Latinos? I think that's what's very promising about the work of the artist like Juno Diaz, Elena Viramontes, is that they're really actually situating that question of the real within the histories of oppression, right? That question itself, is rooted in histories of colonialism, to ask that question, and they challenge the question, and they take the question and they put it into these histories. Juno's novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, Elena Viramontes' most recent novel, and The Dogs Came With Them. They all situate our lives within histories, right? And they all show us the intersections of race, class, gender, sexuality, nation, citizenship, and how these all work. And they kind of and then they play with the notion: can we really know who Latinos are? They play, I think, in my, they play with the narrative of this or a homogeneous, right, narrative of who Latinos are. I think the quest of this process of knowing and unknowing is important, and I think we need to stay in that tension and in the contradictions.
Okay, let me ask Roberto about, has Latino immigration made a gigantic input in music, in popular music, or since the invention of salsa and merengue, merengue,
I will address that question, but I'd like to go back to the concept of the super Latino.
Great.
Because it has some kind of homogeneous aspect to it that it's interesting and troublesome. So when you talk about the super Latino, what do we really mean? I mean, one of the things that bothers me sometimes is that we are homogenizing into a singularity that we are not. We come from different regions. You get the music is very different. The Mexican music is different from the music of the Caribbean. So if you think of a super Latino, so what are we talking about? Is it the absolute conglomeration of this that is neither nor? What does it really imply? Also, the concept of Latino has meant and still means different things at different points in time. In the 40s and the 50s, the migrations were basically from where I come from, which is Puerto Rico, because these were the migrants who came to work in the farms, you know, to pick tomatoes in Connecticut or wherever they were planting tomatoes. And going back to the second question, that's linked to that migration is when you have in the 50s and the 60s the birth of salsa together with Cuban musicians. So there has been indeed, at least in music and on all the other fields, there has been a great impact on American culture. I would say perhaps you can view this equation from both sides. I mean, it's the impact of American cultures on immigrants, but in this case, I would say that it's perhaps more interesting viewpoint is the impact of these immigrants within the American culture, forging in music a sound. There's a sound of an era, for example, the 60s, you know, the sound of New York, this sort of salsa that came out of not only Puerto Rican musicians who were there, and by the way, Puerto Ricans, we are not immigrants, we are American citizens. That's also a kind of interesting note for everybody, because it tells you many things, some of them not so pretty either. So I think that the impact has been felt. It will keep going. The question is, what will it mean 10 years from now? What is that super Latino constituency look like? Which will happen. Demographics will do it. I mean, in any democracy, in any system that works by numbers and by people with the power to agglutinate and to get together and make decisions, that will happen. What that will be, I don't know. Does that mean that we will lose the individual aspects of the different cultures where we come from? How will assimilation also in, I mean, I'm first generation Puerto Rican here and came at a very late age. That's why I have an accent that I'm not even trying to get rid of. But the children and the grandchildren, what will they be like? I mean, what will that super Latino be? Will it be just a Latino, or will it be really a mixture of American and Latino? What is the proportion? It's a hard question to answer, and I think it sort of mainly remains, I don't know if call it a myth, but something that will happen. We just don't know exactly what that will be.
You know, we've been hearing about the sleeping giant. Latinos are the sleeping giant, and there's
we are awake.
Okay. I mean, Juno spoke about the super story. I kind of agree with that. The thing about the super story is that as a people, I think we're all very different. You know, I mean, you can just see it by the foods we eat, you know.
The way we talk.
The way we talk. And for us to actually evolve into something new, we would definitely need a new story. Now, will we be willing to embrace that new story? And will we actually lose something? Juno, what do you
think? Well, I just think that it's like that weird thing of like the house is on fire and everybody's worried about whether the pot roast smells too much, you know? I think that it's this weird situation where, I mean, global capital is demolishing in Latin America the particularity of, let's just take the Dominican Republic, and what I know best. In the Dominican Republic, global capital is demolishing the particularity. In other words, it's just ravaging local music forms. It's just collapsing the diversity of what it means to be Dominican. I mean, every 10 years, what it means to be Dominican, the authentic national question becomes less of a question because there's less shit to choose from. You know, when only two people can play pri-pri, well then, gee whiz. I mean, the issue becomes a lot less important, or at least a lot less compelling. And I guess one of the things that's happening is that in the end, we'll end up being exactly the thing that we're fearing from this Latino category, but capital will deliver it to us. In other words, we're so worried that the larger Latino category robs us of our particularity that we don't notice that capital's doing it for us at the speed of light. In other words, the idea is, of course, that, you know, the idea of a new story is going to depend on that higher order brain, you know, the part of our brain that allows us, if we're an artist or if we're a writer, that allows us to sustain 400 to 600 pages of a novel in your head simultaneously. Even though your conscious mind can't do it, your unconscious higher order brain can. It could contain, at the same time, radical contradictions. It could contain at the same time the identity that I am a thing and I am exactly its opposite. And in my mind, this thing is more of an issue of that it's not a zero-sum game, is that we need a completely new formula, that we need something that can maintain our particularity while having no problems stressing the commonalities and accepting that we can be a thing wholeheartedly but equally be its complete opposite, you know? And so I think the problem is the way our identities are organized right now, everything is a zero-sum game. If I'm a Dominican and reach out to the Mexican community, you feel that by that reaching out, you're dumbing a part of yourself down. The thing is that there's a way to do it where I think every connection, instead of reducing us, brings out more of our complexity. How that works, I have no idea, you know, but I think that we're going to end up wrestling with this question about whether, you know, the super Latino homogenizes us when we're just being homogenized out of the fucking category. You know, like, what could homogenize us more than Budweiser? No, I mean it. Like, what homogenizes us more than, like, the CD? I can't imagine anything. I mean, my mother points out, my mom is like, hey, listen, man, what you consider Dominican is 1/30th of what we consider Dominican. And it's hard to mark that, but I think that that's, you know, we might not even have to worry about the question if we wait 20 years from now. Capital may have reduced us all to a kind of oatmeal. Well, yeah, we all have a lot in common, you know, which is that we're just nothing. You know? So that's my concern, is that I agree, we want to keep our particularity, but we also want to acknowledge that the thing that's reducing our particularity are not strategic choices about solidarity. Strategic choices about solidarity are being blamed, or that they're going to risk who we are. The real risk is something far more nefarious and certainly something that works really well. You know, before this conversation's done, I promise you there's a music form in Latin America that will lose its last, you know, not producer or practitioner, but person who can actually put an album out. And that's for real, you know?
Okay, coming back to immigration, Amy, what do you see it in film? How does it affect in film?
I guess there are lots of ways to look at it. I'm thinking about the ravages of global capital, so I have to shift now to the ways that cinema actually participates in that. I mean, I think that that we're already raising questions that are about the politics of representation and the capacity to speak to one another across identity categories, but also across spaces. And I suppose, you know, maybe one way in is the curator of the most recent Havana Film Festival talked about cinema as another mode of travel. Right? The Cubans would give up weeks of their time to go to the movies to see the rest of the world, certainly the rest of Latin America, which they ordinarily wouldn't see. And we too can see the world and see other lives and other stories through cinema. I guess a smaller area would be, you know, that there are a great number of films that are directly engaging, for example, the question of the border and the new kinds of subjectivities, the new kinds of ravages, the new kinds of violences that borders are producing. I'm thinking about an interesting videotape by a woman named Ursula Beeman called Performing the Border, that looks at the U.S.-Mexico border as a place that's particularly reconfiguring gender politics as women are earning salaries in the maquiladoras and looking to, you know, spend a little sum of money on leisure, that it's kind of refiguring familial and gender politics through these sort of micro practices of capitalism. And so documenting those kinds of things has felt urgent to a lot of political filmmakers who are really interested in the kinds of changes that Juno is describing, at a macro level through the shorthand of Budweiser. There are a lot of adjustments that happen in people's everyday lives that cinema can record and can disseminate so that we understand this beast better. The other thing maybe to mention in terms of immigration is that, you know, you're all aware that the modes of image production are changing, and anybody can make a movie and ought to, you know. So different kinds of stories are circulating through new formats and in different sites. And so we have access, greater access, some would argue, to stories that have been marginalized or that haven't found their ways, as some have found their ways into being optioned, you know. So that there's some room there to tell different kinds of stories.
So it's bringing in new stories, this immigration thing. It's really making them accessible.
That's too positive a spin, I think. You know, in some sense, I think that nobody knows what's happening to the film industry, for example, right? It's as uncertain as any other industry right now. But we do know that you can pick up a camera like that one recording this event today and make a very high quality, sophisticated, somewhat high quality. you can make a fairly decent.
That's
not ratchet it down.
Film, and it can circulate. And there are spaces, the future of festivals is uncertain. They rely on benefactors. They rely on corporate sponsors. Already those things are being pulled. But other sites are emerging as sites for exhibition, and other partnerships are emerging. And I think that's an important change. And who knows what will come of it.
Okay. All right, coming back to immigration, let's talk about the fall of the American economy and Latinos going to other countries. How is that going to affect immigrating to Spain or lo que sea? How will that affect the arts? Let's go with Roberto and then Juno and then Sofia.
Are you talking about affecting the arts in Puerto Rico, here, everywhere?
I think we would... Let's go globally, man. Why not? Let's go.
You're kind of bringing the tragedy that is in my mind to the forefront. Every time I was commenting earlier, every time I look at a publication that I sort of on the web look at, it's called Arts Journal. which collects different articles from the country. I see yet another cultural institution either folding or in deep trouble. And that, of course, has ramifications for everybody, not only Latinos, but for the artistic community at large. I think that as things get tighter economically, I tend to think that we Latinos and minorities in general will be suffering quite substantially. I dare to say perhaps more, because we're always at the tail end of the line. In music in particular, I mean, there certainly you can see that there are less and less venues right now for people to perform. There are less opportunities in terms of grants, in terms of funds available. And again, it's hard to predict the future. I just don't know how deep this will go. But it has gone now deep enough for people to have a sense of, let's call it, desperation. I think that we will probably see, as the global economy worsens, I think we'll probably see more migration. I can see, for example, from Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, people coming here in search of opportunities. At the same time, those opportunities are not going to be as plentiful as they used to be. I can see also the ugly head of racism perking up, you know. As I was watching on TV the other day, somebody talking about the border, and there was this person, I think it was an officer from the city in question. He was saying, well, these people cross the border, they are illegal, so they are criminals. I mean, I was really offended by that, because crossing the border is, how criminal is that? And what does criminal mean? I mean, does it mean that it's like you kill somebody and therefore you should be treated with that kind of despicable attitude? So, but again, as I see it in the larger picture, these are things that are there, but I'm afraid that we'll be faced more with that as things get to be less. Then people tend to get more particular about turf and who is actually legitimate to have a piece of that turf. So, and that inevitably, I mean, I'm talking about larger social issues, but that will inevitably be reflected in what we do and how we are viewed as well.
Yeah, before we go to Juno, I remember Sana Cisneros was here and she said this wonderful anecdote about going to the border and seeing this undocumented worker during when Bush wanted to build that wall, and he had a sign that said, if you deport me, who will build this wall? Okay, Juno, what do you think about this, the fall of the economic?
Damn, I wish he was on the panel. I think it's a really good question, Ernesto, and I mean, I feel like you keep hitting the right, you know, you're sort of bullseyeing exactly what the hell's at stake in some ways, you know. It's weird. It's, you know, you wouldn't think hanging out in the U.S. that we're in a serious economic collapse. Yeah? I mean, I've seen people panic more about, like, losing their dog than I've seen the country panic about what the fuck's going on. I mean, like, 20% of just, like, quote-unquote, the make-believe cash that used to exist just evaporated, you know, across the planet. And I do think, of course, you know how it is. The shit rolls downhill, you know. What's sort of interesting about the way that this works, though, is that it's that kind of weird tension with nobody. You know, I guess the way I'm saying is nobody knows better than to live without than folks in the third world. I mean, you don't want to put too fine a gloss on it. You don't want to, like, say, oh, how quaint. You know, they're great survivors. But I do think that there's going to be a tension. In other words, that simply the lack of opportunity means that our home countries are going to have to endure miseries that they haven't endured in 15, 16, 17 years. I know in Santo Domingo, you know, things have been jacked up in the DR forever, but for the last 15 years, things have been okay in third world ranking. What I mean by that is that I'd like to see what people think of Santo Domingo a year from now when all the remittances stop, when all the money that we send back home stop, and that a lot of the kind of middle-class elites in the Dominican Republic have actually benefited from the lower classes receiving what I would call international welfare. And when that gets cut off, you're going to have a tremendous crisis in the social order. You know, in Santo Domingo, all they talk about all the time is delincuencia, you know? Mm-hmm. But they don't know what delincuencia means till this damn economy hits, and hits hard. And I think that we're going to see it in a number of areas. And as far as the arts are concerned, I always think that during all those quote-unquote, you know, capital loves to tell us those were good times under Clinton, you know, great times. You know? But one of the really fucked up things that happened during the great times is that despite all these institutions that we had that were receiving, guys, they were receiving incredible loads of money. I mean, if you look at some of the institutions, you know, there are institutions that are arts institutions in the United States that were getting more money per year than the GMP of some countries in the Caribbean. And one of the strange things is that when the times were good, the easiest thing to have done was to convince people that arts are good and that arts are important. And that's kind of free. And I think what's interesting is that the situation, the larger population, the arts, no matter what, are still viewed as completely dispensable. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just the country at large that when times get hard, they're going to cut the arts out. I think the average family thinks that, like, a trip to the museum, fuck that. You know, things are really hard because we didn't spend the last 20 years sort of convincing people. And I think it's a lot easier to do than to get people to come to a gallery show. To convince people that arts are important, that's just like an abstract little story. You know, it could have been an easy jingle that we could have done. But I think that what we're going to suffer now is that the average person, whether it's in the United States or the Dominican Republic or wherever, thinks of art as something that comes only when you have excess. Yeah, that it's like a commodity, that it's like the we. When times are good, we'll get you the we. You know, where I think that hopefully during the next quote-unquote good time in capital, we can do a better job of convincing people, not only at the level of individual families, that arts is absolutely indispensable. And I think that arts education during the good times we saw, all of us saw, was completely cut, and it just kept cutting and cutting and cutting. And that's what they did during the good time. I mean, what are they going to do now? And I think we just need a shot. We need a shot to be able to convince groups of people that arts education is fundamental. And because we're not doing a bad job of creating artists, guys. If you add up all the MFA programs in the country, dude, we create artists. It's like a machine. You know, we pump them the fuck out. The problem is that we haven't created communities or collectives that could actually receive or interact with that art, you know, which is, it's kind of called the Obama situation. You know, we don't have a problem creating an exceptional black man. Obama ain't the only one, guys. Creating exceptional individuals ain't a fucking problem. It's creating collectives that have a certain kind of education that would allow for this kind of interplay. That's been the great difficulty, you know? And I wish we could get rid of like 9/10 of the MFAs and use that money to create communities, you know, where it's like instead of MFAs being like, oh, I'm going to become an artist, turn them into like, you know, Peace Corps for people who go into communities. Instead of digging wells, teach people that fucking arts are fundamental, you know, because our energies were directed in the wrong direction. And now if the money's gone, we see it. We produce a ton of artists, and we produce no communities to receive them.
I think that's very interesting. What you mentioned is that the relationship between the arts and capital. The problem is that history tells you that there has always been that link, and that not even the Great Depression of the 30s broke that link in this country, for example. So the question is, And I agree with what you're saying. The question is, can that link be broken? Will this great recession do it, if not eventually a depression? It's going by historical models, it's arguable that it may continue to be linked in the ways that you're describing that may not be healthy.
Yeah, but we haven't really tried. I'm saying, like, when's the last time historically in the last 80 years that you can name 10,000 individuals directed in a project to attempt to break the link? It's not a huge project, guys. But I guess I'm saying that we haven't really tried. We've left it up to nature. Well, we hope the relationship will break.
But we haven't tried for centuries.
I agree. But now we have money and we have a bunch of young people and we've got a... I mean, the population of youth...
I hope, right.
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. I think just because it didn't... I think that's more than possible. But mira, Sofia, what do you see happening in education with the fall of the economic...
I think for Latinos, schooling will become dispensable. Right. In other words, I mean, not only just the attitudes about, you know, immigrants taking our jobs away, you know, let's close the border, but, you know, those attitudes becoming policy, I think, with regard to education and the taking, and already, you know, Latinos are ghettoized, right? Latinos, a huge percentage, right? The majority of Latinos attend schools with other Latinos, right? They attend segregated schools. And so, yes, I think that will be getting worse. I think just bilingual education or even just attention to language in the schools, right? And putting resources into, I mean, forget about cultivating bilingualism, but just providing English as a second language services. I think those kinds of things will become scarce, and also just a crisis not only in arts but also with sciences, right? With the sciences, and you know, Latinos not being able to invest their identities in the sciences, and maybe I don't know if you'd say in the arts right now, like that's something else, right? That's the arts are indispensable.
Not to cut you off. Mm-hmm. All right, let's say that I am I'm in Colombia, right? And I have some money. I don't have a lot of money, but I have a little bit of money. And I want my children to have good education. Would it be better for me to actually go to Spain or to come to the United States? Mm-hmm. Before, it was no-brainer. Uh-huh. USA, JFK, uh-huh. John Lennon. Uh-huh. Now, that's gone, right? Okay. What...
In terms of educating.
Education.
Education.
Yeah, it's you.
Yeah, it depends where they land, right, when they come here. You know, what communities. Again, if they land in a poorly resourced school.
Most likely.
Most likely, uh-huh. You know, maybe Spain. That's where Ecuadorians are going.
That's where they're going.
I think Spain beat the U.S. now in terms of
All right, last question before I open it up for the audience to ask any of the panelists any questions. Last question for the panelists, and I want all of your answers. I do, okay? last question before we open it up. Now that we have Obama in the White House, thank God, what about a Latino president, and do we actually want one with the United States on its back? Let's start with Juno. It is on its back. Sorry.
I guess it's such a tough question. It's like and it's not to say that Eduardo is intentionally bedeviling us, you know. But it's such a tough question because it's sort of like someone asking you, do you want a wish? And my first reaction is never yes. It's like, what do you want, you know, for that wish? And it's almost like, I'm sure we can get a Latino president, but unfortunately my fear is that we'll get the exact kind of Latino president that would be my like ultimate nightmare, you know, the kind of Latino who get the apologies to my Cuban neighbors, but we'll get like the super hyper conservative white Cuban who speaks better Spanish than me, you know, and who's
extraordinarily handsome and charismatic and, like, you know, and been to an Ivy League school, but it's like, you know, wants to kill people who provide abortions and wants to atomic bomb Cuba. And, you know, I'm sure we could get a super conservative lunatic, you know, but a progressive one. I would love to have one, you know, but will we get one? I think, hell, I mean, fucking this dumbass country elected Obama. So I'm like, wow, we're capable of all sorts of amazing things, you know, so I'm pretty positive. I mean, for real, guys, 4 years after electing Bush, dumbasses elected Obama. So you got to be hopeful, you know. They're like, we're not bad. I mean, we're not entirely bad.
Sophia?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking that it would be true, right, that under Bush we had the most diverse cabinet with Condoleezza Rice and Powell and Gonzalez. And so I'm reminded of, you know, what you're saying.
They're all criminals.
Yeah, so... yeah, so it... yeah, you know, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful with Obama. If we elected Obama, I think we could elect a progressive Latino. Yeah, I mean, that
would be it. Yeah, Amy, you got some Cuban blood, so
yeah, right.
Go for it.
You know that guy you're afraid of? That's my grandfather.
I knew it. I knew it.
An asshole of the highest order. So, yeah, I mean, the world changed for me in the election of Obama, and I don't know what to make of this, the world that we live in today. It's really, really screwed up. So... not sure.
Roberto?
I will follow up on that because I was thinking and trying to answer this question. Of course, it can happen. I mean, again, demographics at some point may dictate it, but the question is, what will this country be like? I mean, will it be still the United States? Or will it be... I mean, there was already the talk publicly of secessionism, even amongst the Republican inner circle, you know, like Mrs. Palin's husband, who was associated to secessionist movements and so on. And this is not a joke. I mean, these are realities. These are political thoughts on which I don't want to make. I have my own judgments, but I won't tell them right now. Well, they are awful, but anyway. but the question is, I think that's a process that may take a long time, and in taking that long time, again, I don't know what I have no clear picture of what the future looks like. Personally, I'm not clear. I'm not clear what effects this downturn, of which I am rather pessimistic, what that will mean not only in the United States, in the world. I mean, they were talking about Spain here. I was in Madrid 4 weeks ago, and the unemployment rate in Madrid was 14%, projected to be 20% in 2009. You are talking social unrest at those levels. So it's a very interesting question, hard to predict. The possibility, yes, but I don't know either.
Okay. It's definitely a fun question, and I also think it's an important question. African Americans been asking for a black president for decades, and I think we should start. Anyway, audience, anyone wants to ask a question? See, la señorita.
So, me being the eternal optimist, looking at your collective success here, do you find that as you have become more successful, that you've actually inspired more Latinos coming from other countries to actually come try and mimic that success.
I don't feel like my individual story could compare to the colossal pull of the heart of empire, like the metropole.
I'm sorry, I'm talking about from an artist perspective. So an artist in, let's say, the Dominican Republic or Colombia might be more inspired by you now and might actually make the move to come and actually practice his art here in the States.
I mean, again, I can only speak of Santo Domingo, but the average Dominican artist is desperate to get to the United States or Europe anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's fucked up. I mean, I love my country, but few are the artists like the great Tony Capellan, painter, installation, video, who actually wants to stay in Santo Domingo, has been offered multiple times to leave. You know, most of the Dominican artists I know, as soon as they're offered a chance to get out, they're out. And I only know one of our great, great artists, Tony Capellan, who's actually stayed. So I think it's like, it's hard, the force of these things, of these privileges, is really hard to deal with.
Yes.
You were talking about how the arts education has failed to produce a public for our artists, but also have not the artists ourselves have failed to appeal to the public that is there? Like, at the same time that we made major efforts to educate people to look into the arts, haven't the arts been pulling away from the people?
And Caballero, this question is for anyone, or is it for someone? Amy, you want to take that?
Sure.
You're fidgeting.
I'm thinking. I think that my immediate response is that there are multiple communities, and artists have a responsibility to try to speak widely, to engage with people, and to engage with what people are thinking about. So, you know, in cinema studies is a sort of commonplace that during the Depression, musicals were the most popular films because they distracted, right? They were a source of fantasy and joy and, you know, pure movement, and gave people an escape from the glumness of their lives during the Depression. And in fact, sure, there were musicals and they appealed to people, and so did comedies, but there are a lot of really important films of social protest that were made during the Depression too, that were speaking to equally to the reality of people's lives, to the hardships they were enduring, but they were trying to constitute those people into political collectivities, and trying to understand the complexities of political life in the United States in the mid-century. So, you know, there are various ways, I suppose, of talking about whether we failed to engage people or succeeded in engaging people. There are lots of films right now engaging people, and a lot of filmmakers and a lot of novelists whose work is touching the complexity of people's lives right now. So it's hard for me to diagnose whether artists have failed. I think I agree with Juno that we, and we try to do this in the university too, that we can always be reaching beyond those people who are connecting with us. And we can always be thinking about new platforms and trying to teach students beyond where we are at any given moment. But I think in some ways what we're doing at the university level is really vital.
Yes, I agree with that. I think there was Juno talked about building a community to receive the arts. And I think there was a time, maybe even before my time, when there was an embarrassment to not have read some certain books. If you did not read this book, there was some certain embarrassment there. And I don't think that's there anymore. I think it's completely changed, and I think there's actually more books being written than they are being read. But anyway, next question. Pardon? Oh, sorry. A la señorita aquí.
Hi, I particularly like this idea of the Peace Corps for the Arts. And I was wondering just in light of this economic downturn and subsequent lack of funding, especially for the arts that we're staring down right now, do you have any ideas or action steps that we all might think about in terms of engaging not just the immigrant population, but just engaging people in the arts right now and really imbuing them with this idea that the arts are important in creating these communities to receive the artists that we're producing?
Look, I think it's very interesting the way that,
the way that certain practices, and certain quote-unquote professions get organized. I mean, we have absolutely no problems thinking about taking a totally unprepared middle-class kid and sending them to a, you know, hardcore urban school to educate those kids. I mean, that's what Teach America is all about, you know? Most of these kids are deeply unprepared, despite what they claim that they're not. But we have no problems with that. We think that teaching is just a good, and even if it's kind of flawed, we can send folks in there. But again, we tend not to think the category of artists gets organized, we tend not to think of artists as someone that has to be thrown into a community to do their work. You know, and I think that one of the areas we begin with is trying to figure out and trying to talk about reconstructing the artist apprentice category to involve what we expect out of teaching and out of teachers. Right now, the claim of the artist is at the most functional level is that they come to an institution and burrow in, and when they run out of money, they leave. But I'm like, yo, if they're getting this fucking money, I'm not sure Cornell will be the worse for it if we took all our art students and sent them away half the time to go work in some crazy neighborhoods to try to convince people that arts is good. I'm not sure Cornell would suffer at all. And these other communities, I think, would benefit deeply. You know?
Gentlemen?
Has any of you looked at the 60s and all those, when this guy, before he became famous, when all these artists are out there in the communities and all working across disciplines? Not the depression, but is that a model? Is that a model to think about when there was very yeasty time, cross pollinization, not inside the university, but right there in the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a dream of that rhythm too. I mean, part of it is I wasn't raised there. I wasn't born there, but you know, I was born in '68. But one of the things I remember from my early years was that the rhythm of life permitted folks to do stuff that we wouldn't imagine now doing. I mean, life was just lived. I can remember my first 10 years, and I remember these last 10 years. And it's not about me getting older or me being younger. The rhythm of life has changed so much, you know?
You mean a faster pace and more different values?
The best way to describe it is
anybody been
Italy recently? And compare the rhythm of life in Italy, or you've been to like the Campo in Santo Domingo, compared to the rhythm of life, is that people's idea of how time works was different. And when people's idea of what time works is more generous, I think there's more of a chance for folks to be in a community. But when, as soon as you arrive, somebody turns the hourglass over, you make very different decisions than when you're not thinking about the hourglass. So yes, I think it's for me, it's a model on a number of levels. Not simply for just the kind of the way the arts work, but also the rhythm of how people engage with art and life.
Well, you know, with the fall of the economic, people might actually take time and smell the roses, working hard to get the Cadillac. Anyway, señorita y después otra señorita.
So my question is about your Peace Corps for the arts thing. So just wondering, so you said instead of sending people to build wells in third world countries, why don't you send them in and, you know, to develop the arts there or something like that. But how receptive do you think communities would be, you know, if they don't have wells or other necessities?
I wasn't hoping that we would replace one for the other. I'm just saying, I haven't noticed any of the, look, again, I don't know,
I teach at MIT. My students are awesome at generating numbers. Whether you believe in numbers or not, that's another issue. Yeah? For real, like, I don't want to use numbers to sort of make a point, but I think it's important. None of our interventions in the last 30 years have decreased the amount of poor people who die from starvation and from lack of medical. In fact, misery has increased in the last 40 years. You know? It's like they always point out, it was better to be poor in Africa in 1960 than it is to be poor in Africa now. So it's not that I don't think that it's got to be one or the other, Wells or Enjoy Dance. You know, I was just making more of a kind of a point that, you know, in the end, we've got to start figuring out how to do things in a new way. Because, I don't know, it doesn't look like the shit we're doing now is working too well.
Yeah, numbers. Mark Twain's famous line, their lies are damn lies, and then their stats.
Yeah.
Okay, señorita.
Given the insidiousness of capitalism and, you know, the way that migration habits in Latin America have really changed, you know, the character of what it means to be Latino and, you know, the Latino experience, whether it's abroad or the U.S., I wanted to know if you folks had any thoughts on how these same things have affected the indigenous in Latin America and their production of art, and if you have any hope whatsoever for the preservation of their cultures in the face of, as you mentioned, the atomization of the individual and communities as well.
Well, I think this is a larger issue than what can really be addressed in one simple answer, but you can assume, and I don't have the statistics and the facts that any impact that as big as the one we are living now will definitely have an effect. And again, it's a matter, is the pyramid. So who is at the bottom? And we know who are at the bottom. So Juno was mentioning earlier, sort of he commented, at this moment there is a way of doing music that is going to be disappearing right now as we are having this panel, and that in a way answers your question. We can assume that there is a way of writing a copla that somebody is the last person in that village that knows how to do it, but I guess at the end that's the inevitability of the terrible things of evolving as mankind. I mean, also the fact that although we have more resources now, more people are starving now. I mean, that's another such paradox. So I was also thinking, going back to the questions of how it impacts also the artist, I tend to think, and that applies also to the indigenous people, I'm a pessimist, but I'm very hopeful because I think that we do what we do because we cannot do anything else. I mean, I'm a composer, so I write music because I have to. And we will find ways of doing what we do without the resources that were there last year. I mean, if I cannot write for an orchestra, I'll write for a piano. Or I just write it on paper and hopefully someday somebody will play it. So the manifestation of art itself will exist, persist, and be there. It's just a matter of adaptation. The question from the gentleman here, people will find ways to group together, to be smart, to get art out there in whichever way we can. So I'm pessimistic because it's going to be terrible, but hopeful because we have this spirit that is the human spirits, you know, the essence is inevitable, is indomitable, and will be there.
Okay, let's take like two more questions. This gentleman and then this lady.
Do you think that immigration for Latin artists like yourself, the immigration to places like the United States, like, does it motivate them to talk about their origins and their ethnicity? Because, for example, in your book, you talk a lot about Laila and and I know that I'm Dominican, and I know exactly what you're talking about. I don't know if like people from the United States know what you're talking about. You know? So, does it like normally like inspired them to talk about their roots and stuff?
Not always. I wouldn't say it's predetermined, because I know plenty of Dominican artists who, what they do is, as artists, is anything but Dominican. You know, I mean, in Santo Domingo, again, you don't want to generalize too much, because culture, we're talking about 10 million damn people, like spread across like the majority of them over six countries, you know. It's hard to guess, but you know, there's a whole category of Dominicans that as soon as they hear bachata, they leave the room. Do you know what I'm saying? They don't want nothing to do with what would be considered folkloric, organic Dominicanness, you know? So I would never say that immigrating to another place automatically says that you're going to talk about your roots. In fact, a lot of people use the movement to another place to reinvent themselves as a quote-unquote cosmopolitan, you know, deracinated artist. And I have a group of friends, again, I mean, their politics really scare me, but they're friends. You know, you gotta have friends with different politics, who are in Spain, and nothing of their work speaks to anything about the Dominican Republic. And they've really reconstructed themselves as these kind of cosmopolitan, i.e. white, you know, kind of artists. I think that there's always a tension between talking about the origins, your sort of cultural, historical, geographic origins, and attempting to somehow become a new person. And you've seen it played, again, generation after generation after generation, people having this argument again and again and again, that to be an authentic artist, you have to do X, Y, and Z. No, no, to be an authentic artist, you have to do A, B, and C. My thing is less the idea that one side is right or the other is wrong, but the idea that we have to keep every single strategy open and available. I despise the people who tell people that they shouldn't write about the Dominican Republic as much as I despise people who tell other artists that they should write about their roots. I think the important part is to keep all those strategies not only available, but to be considered valid. Because you never know, the very person who doesn't write about anything to be Dominican is the person who 70 years later is the most important Dominican artist. And the person who quote-unquote writes about the authentic Dominican self is the person who's most irrelevant. It's very, very hard to judge how these things shake out. So what's most important, I think, is that the process of immigration should be a way to keep all these strategies available and to have access to new strategies, you know? Because fuck, man, if you leave your country and you don't incorporate new strategies, that's a lot of pain to learn nothing. You know, it's a lot of hurt. I mean, it hurts to immigrate. I mean, it's wonderful too, but it hurts. And if you're going to hurt, you might as well learn new shit and see what you can make of it.
Yes, Borges said, we know the Quran is an Arab text because it doesn't have any camels. Madam.
I wanted to ask Sophia. So thinking about numbers and thinking about the growth of the Latino population in this country, do you have any hopes or that there are strategies that will make the school environment more receptive to the population? Because, you know, again, I think a whole group will be lost if, you know, if that doesn't happen.
Yes, I was just reading a book on off the press called The Latino Educational Crisis, and it's very alarming. The Latino Educational Crisis. But Janelle and my colleagues here give me hope, and the idea of communities, taking charge of our children in the school, of sending our artists to the schools. Right, because the teaching and learning process is a process that is about kids investing their identities in it. And if they don't see themselves in that process, if they don't see themselves in the curriculum, we have to overcome without these resources. But I see that hope. And I see the hope in the communities and the families and the parents being empowered, and the artists and the scientists, right, being empowered to come back to participate in the schools, to participate in the conversations about how to make education better. So I see that, and I see, you know, there in our field we're trying to reconceptualize parental involvement and what that means. But it really comes down to parents finding the tools within their own families, right, within our own families, to be able to talk to schools from our own terms. So I do see the resources, aren't there and won't be there, it seems. But I think the spirit, hopefully the hope and the spirit of our families can go a long way.
Yeah, I second that. Okay, let me closing remarks. Amy, anything you'd like to say before we adjourn?
I'd just like to thank you all for coming and really look forward to more from Juno in a little while, and come support the arts at Cornell. I hope we see you all at the Schwartz Center frequently.
Roberto?
Again, I want to thank you all for being here with us. I'm glad I was here, too, from this side of the table. It's been very interesting and thought-provoking. Listen to as much music as you can before some of it disappears.
Yeah, it's
okay. Igualmente, thank you. Gracias for being here. And I learned so much. I learned so much from this dialogue and from this conversation. I think this collective and camaraderie is so important.
Juno?
Yeah, no, thanks, everybody. And, I always look for the most... I always look for the most explicit kind of physical metaphor to remind us, look, things are really tough, man. You don't want to put a bow on a turd and say it's a cake, Things are really tough out there and people are really suffering. But I'm always reminded, especially as someone from the Caribbean, we have a whole collection of folks, that you look at the Caribbean and it's basically the source of some of the greatest defeats of humanity and some of the greatest exterminations, and yet it still produced perhaps the most dynamic culture on the planet. Is that it's, it's what my colleagues were saying. It's like, we're weird damn species, man. Anytime you think people've got their foot on our necks, we turn around and we invent salsa. And I think that that's really something that should never be underestimated. That's why, these times really suck, but the fingers are crossed that they're crossed because not determined. You just hope that we're going to do it again, that we're going to do it again, that things are tough and we're going to show why this little monkey species is worth the air it breathes by being extraordinarily dynamically creative,
Yeah, thanks for that. Things are really bad. I hear sperm banks are also going broke. But anyway, with that, I'd like to thank everyone, my colleagues, Juno, Sofia, Amy, Roberto, Helena, once a minute, and thanks again.